coming. We only have a couple of quick intro slides, so we'll be able to launch right into the talks. Just wanted to go over a brief look at the charge. Oh, and also to introduce ourselves. There's been a shift in who's sort of convening this neutrino physics working group. So this year it is myself, Louise, and Zarco, who are have been organizing this. So if you have any complaints, suggestions, anything like that, send us an email and we'll address them. Before we started launching into the talks for today, though, I wanted to give everybody a look at the brief charge that we were given in organizing this. Specifically, what the goal of this exercise is to reach out to the division and all interested peoples and get an idea of what we're interested in for the decade following the year 2026. So a lot of this is sort of aimed at that sort of date. Where will we be in 2026? What will be the hot topics then? What will you guys be interested in doing then? So I won't read through this whole charge, but you can get a sense for what the point of this exercise is and what we're hoping to achieve from it. In the end, this will be turned into a presentation and a report that will feed into the All Scientists Retreat on April 26th. And just so you know, we have slotted in some discussion time in between the talks, but these are short. So we won't be able to have a full at-length discussion. So what we would say is please take notes and send any thoughts that you have to us in an email. And what we'll do is we'll use this to help build the agenda for the next meeting, which will be scheduled very soon. And in addition, if you have an idea that you would like to discuss or present at the next meeting, let us know and we'll put you on the agenda. So any questions or comments before we get started? Since our first speaker isn't here yet, maybe we'll skip over and start with Steven if he's willing to.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
I think you'll
Actually,
need.
it might work better this way.
Well, it's the remote people.
No, I think we should have the.
Order. Of course, that doesn't matter. Is walking
I think probably makes more sense for Steven to go first anyway.
Okay.
What?
You two can.
Does it make more sense for you to go first anyway?
It doesn't matter.
You want to stay? No.
I haven't done my slides.
Okay.
Okay, how bad does that sound? Is there anybody on the phone?
There.
Okay. All right. So sorry for being late. Okay. As an overview, I got a request a little while back from Louise to present the future, or if I change the stress on this, I can represent the challenge by saying present the future, like bring the future into the present. So it's what we will know in 2026, and she asked me also to say what we know we will likely have learned in the decade thereafter. 1001 tenses for the time traveler. And the caveat is that prognostications fall into a spectrum from informed guess up to guess. Okay, so just to reiterate the important questions, I know people are pretty well educated in this, but related to the P5 science driver, either explicitly or implicitly, the P5 science driver understand the physics associated with the neutrino mass. What is the structure of the mixing? The most kind of open question on that in terms of mixing angles is theta 2-3 maximal, that is it pi over 4, meaning equal contributions of nu mu and nu tau to nu 3. If not, what is the octant? Is it lower, meaning theta 2-3 less than pi over 4, so more nu tau and nu 3, or is in the upper octant with more new mu and new 3. What is the ordering? That is new 3 the one that happens to have the least electron content, heavier than the other two with a normal mass ordering or hierarchy, or is it lighter in an inverted hierarchy? What are the absolute masses? Do neutrinos violate CP? Are they their own antiparticle? And are there additional neutrino types and interactions? So looking at this first through the lens of long baseline oscillations, I've grayed out the ones that are not directly addressable through long baseline oscillations. So absolute masses, we obviously can't say anything about. I grayed out, but not completely, the question of are they their own antiparticle, because the determination of the mass hierarchy will bear on the interpretation of neutrinoless double beta decay experiments or results. Okay, so to get a bit more specific in the long baseline oscillations, the muon neutrino disappearance, so just looking at the beam of neutrinos right after it's produced and again after a long distance, is primarily, so the survival probability is primarily sensitive to the absolute value of the atmospheric mass splitting, delta m squared 3-1, and sine squared of 2 theta 2-3. So it's not sensitive to the mass hierarchy, and it can probe the maximality or the degree of non-maximality of theta 2-3, but not the octant because of that factor of 2 there in the sine. And it's not sensitive to CP violation either, unless CPT were to be violated, which of course, there's a theorem that says that doesn't happen in relativistic local quantum field theories. Okay, the electron antineutrino appearance has sensitivity to CP violation through an explicit appearance of the CP violating phase delta, the mass hierarchy via the matter effect, and theta 2, 3 octant due to, I left out a squared here, but appearance of sine squared theta 2, 3 without that factor of 2 in the leading term of the oscillation probability. So this can be represented graphically. If we ask nature at a fixed baseline, a fixed energy, in a certain physics scenario, tell us what should we expect for the appearance probability for anti-muon neutrinos to anti-electron neutrinos versus the same just for neutrinos. It would be rather boring. You would just get one point. They would be equal. This is if there's no matter effect, no CP violation, and maximal mixing. When we turn on CP violation, we get a difference between the antineutrino and neutrino appearance probabilities that turns the point into an ellipse, and where you are on the ellipse is related to the value of delta CP. And then if we turn on matter effects, the mass ordering comes into play. For a normal mass ordering, you would enhance the neutrino probabilities, appearance probabilities, and suppress the antineutrino, and vice versa for the inverted hierarchy. And in NOVA, that is about a 22% effect, and in TDK, it's about 11%. And this is still for maximal theta 2-3. So then if we allow theta 2-3 to move away from pi over 4, then if you go into the upper octant, you generally enhance the probabilities and you suppress them if you go into the lower octant. So there's actually quite a rich bit of phenomenology there in the appearance probabilities. Furthermore, the sensitivity to all of these things above does depend very strongly on the use of an external constraint of theta 1-3, which we get from reactors. So that's enhanced the capability of these long baseline experiments, of course. And we use our own muon neutrino disappearance probabilities as well to maximize our sensitivity to all the equations. The joint fit, I should say. I won't get into this. I ran out of time to incorporate this, but there's also sensitivity to the effect of sterile neutrinos on long baselines. For example, theta 2-4 and theta 3-4 in a 3 plus 1 model through neutral current disappearance. So the sum of all three active flavors should stay the same if that's all there is. But if there is a sterile neutrino, then you can have disappearance in the neutral current. And NOVA is not particularly competitive, but maybe Louise is an expert on this a bit here in theta 2-4 for small theta 3-4. Do I have that the right way around? Or and then also there's the possibility of non-standard interactions, looking at an alternative interpretation of nu E versus nu E bar appearance, comparison of the two outside of the framework that I just talked about. All right, so just a few words about where Nova is before I talk about where it's going. So, you know, Nova, of course, has currently 700 kilowatt beam. The magnetic horns that focus the hadrons into the decay pipe can be, their polarity can be selected to give us a high purity muon neutrino or anti-muon neutrino beam. The beam is directed towards two detectors. The FAR detector is big. It's in Ash River, Minnesota, 810 kilometers away, 14 kilotons, about 15 meters on a side, 60 meters long. And if you drill into a little point here and blow it up, you would see a PVC cell structure that's holding a liquid scintillator. And then there's the 300-ton NIR detector at Fermilab. This just illustrates, sorry, it's a little bit small for the room, the event topologies as seen in the detector that we are mostly concerned about. There's a muon neutrino charge current event where we have a several meter long track here, a nice strong muon track with a Michel electron at the end, typically or often. And then an event with similar kinematics, but an electron neutrino producing an electron, which is still a reasonably long track, but shorter than the muon and fuzzier. And then the common potential background or neutral current events, where we have a pi naught, and of course the photons, or one of them can fake an electron, but we can often resolve the gap that it took for the photon to convert into an electromagnetic shower after it was produced. So our most recent results were presented at a Wine and Cheese just back in January using all our neutrino data collected to date. I mean, specifically neutrino mode data, what we call forward horn current. And that's almost an exposure of almost 9 times 10 to the 20 protons on target. We say 14 kiloton equivalent because we started taking data before the FAR detector was completed. So we always make that adjustment for that data set. And that data taking started in February of 2014 and went through February of 2017 with usual summer shutdowns and a little bit of other anti-neutrino running. So this is the muon neutrino disappearance spectrum. The green one is the one, of course, that nobody has believed in for more than 20 years now that we would have in the absence of oscillations. But what we actually see is 126 events. You see the data down here in the black dots and then the best fit in the red histogram. And that's on a background of about 9 events. I don't think I've ever been in this room without a software update being required. This is the electron neutrino spectrum. You see it repeated 3 times in 3 different bins of electron neutrino candidate selection purity. So you see the backgrounds become a smaller fraction as you go from this bin to this bin to this one. And then there's a special kind of, we call it the peripheral sample. It's this non-energy divided bin recovering events that look like nice pure electrons, electron neutrinos near the edge of the detector. So we have 66 events on a background of 21. We go and interpret these results in the three-flavor framework. This is a atmospheric parameter contour. So the dark one here is Nova, but this is the result of a joint fit of both the muon and electron neutrino data sets. And we are now compatible with maximal mixing at 0.8 sigma. There's only a very slight and significant preference for the upper octant over the lower at this point. And we look at the parameters we associate more directly with the electron neutrino appearance. These are significance contours as a function of the mass hierarchy. So blue is normal, red is inverted, and then dividing it further into the 2 octants, the dashed one for the upper octant, sorry, the lower octant, the solid one for the dash. And you see our best fit is does actually give a healthy amount of CP violation, but it's still completely compatible with CP conservation at delta CP of 0 or pi or 2 pi. Here you see the octant not being particularly significant. However, the normal hierarchy or the inverted hierarchy is disfavored now at almost 2 sigma in the NOVA data, and this is before we use any anti-neutrino data. How am I doing on time? What time did I start? About 10 past?
Yeah,
10
past. 10 minutes.
So I think I covered that. Okay, so looking to the future, NOVA has been collecting anti-neutrino mode data since February of last year, and that's been almost entirely at 700 kilowatts. We don't always get that every day. We pay a tax for when the switchyard is on, et cetera, but there have been plenty of times where we've been above 700, so we're doing quite well on that, and the beam up time has been good. So now we're working on our first anti-neutrino sets with about 7 times 10 to the 20 protons on target. And we are working towards our first results on that at summer conferences. Our guidance from program planning, which was just reiterated today, one of the reasons I'm late from the proton PMG meeting, is that we can expect to run until the long shutdown for LBNF construction in 2024. I think about mid-2024 is the way it looks on their calendar. So we project out sensitivities, taking that into account, but also with some improvements. These may not all be 100% realized on the timeline we give here, but there are other factors in play that can make it all pretty much come out in the wash. So we're assuming 800 kilowatts in fiscal year 19, and then 900 kilowatts in fiscal year 21. That's there are some accelerator improvement projects going on to help increase the beam intensity out of the booster, make the target NUMMI target more robust, or target system more robust to handle that. We're also looking into some possible target redesign. We're not sure if we're going to be able to realize that. It gives about a 17% improvement in the neutrino flux per proton on target, and various analysis improvements. We first were presenting these plots about a year ago. We were assuming we would achieve a 25% analysis improvement. We've already realized about 15% of that. So now these reflect what we actually have achieved, plus an additional improvement now of about 12%.
What will make 800 kilowatts?
We have a question coming.
What is that will bring the 800 kilowatt? Does it need any adjustments from the NOVA side, or it is?
The target system was designed for 700 kilowatts. We might have a little bit of leeway to go above that, but that's what I'm saying. Not the NOVA side, the NUMMI side. We definitely for the 900 would need. Bob can maybe talk more definitively. Are you going to actually cover any of this in your talk? No. Okay, but. It's mainly what booster is it RF or it's reducing losses?
There's a wire. So there's a set of AIPs to do all this and I'm sorry, who was asking the question? Oh, yeah, it was. Yes. I think you're mostly familiar with them. There's booster upgrades that have to be done, main injector upgrades that have to be done, and target station upgrades that need to be done, and all of it is to achieve the same level of reliability that we've had in recent years.
But you see, when I was curious, I usually hear the 900 kilowatt. I was not aware that we plan to have a gradual approach, and that next year it will be 800.
Well, I started off saying we may not achieve all of that on the timescale we've given. This was when we first developed this upgrade scenario, which is upgrade, but in improved power scenario. That was the original timeline. But we've gotten some feedback that
not
necessarily strictly limited to 700 kilowatts.
We can go up to about 730 kilowatts now, and it might be a touch higher than that in the near future. But it's unlikely we'd exceed 800 kilowatts until next summer. And, there's a certain amount of uncertainty with this. And so to the 15%, that's right there. I don't get too worried about that. I mean, our goal is to try to get to, somewhere close to a megawatt over the next few years. That being said, the actual AIPs have not been approved yet. They were supposed to start at the beginning of fiscal year 18, and they were caught up into the budget mess, and even though that's resolved on the top level, that has not trickled down yet. So these have not technically started yet. So we're 6 months behind there.
Another important thing to keep in mind is we don't actually care at the end of the day about power. We care about protons delivered per year, and things have been running quite smoothly. I think we're above the base certainly this year by now, and maybe above the design already. The upper red curve.
I don't think so.
Getting close. No, Bob doesn't think so. But getting close.
Yeah. Let me add a few words to what Bob said. As far as I understand, booster will be ready for 1.2 megawatt in a few years. And it's not going to be expensive. If you can do this and know how to do this. Next stopping point, it's main injector. 900 kilowatt, it's set by main injector RF. If we will pay for main injector RF upgrade, which is, I think, about somewhere in between $20 and $30 million, you will be at 1.2 megawatt by 23, 25, something like this. Maybe even faster. It depends how money will come. And the last thing, it's targetry. Bob mentioned that present target, you cannot run too much. With well-upgraded target, we should be able to run at 1.2 megawatt by something like 23, maybe even earlier. But it will happen only if there will be strong pressure and good support.
I would say a part of what used to be called PIP 1 Plus was RF upgrade to get to 1.2 second cycle time, but I think that is now actually not, at least not part of an AIP that would be realized on Nova's timeline. Is that still correct?
We still want to get to a 1.2 second cycle time, yes.
You still want to get to 1.2?
But that's contingent upon other users.
Yeah.
If G minus 2 or mu to E are running, we're stuck at a 1.4 second cycle time.
Yes, so Bob was just saying that's we could still get to 1.2 seconds, but only in the absence of the muon experiments taking data. And we'll actually be at 1.4 second cycle time instead of what has been, until just a few weeks ago, the nominal 1.33.
I would like to add that actually, if there is a... If you really want, you can make present complex running at 20 hertz. It addresses the problem, and it's not going to be very expensive.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Present booster runs at 15 hertz. We could make it running at 20 hertz, similar to what we expect from PIP2. And again, it's not very expensive, but it could address this problem.
Yeah, that was specifically the item that I thought had not made it into a current AIP, but...
I see. Okay, yes. Yeah. So that's not necessarily an RF upgrade.
Okay.
But yes. Presently planned, or will happen at the very end.
If you don't ask, you will not get.
We should probably move on with this discussion, otherwise we'll never.
Oh, I didn't even finish the slide. I'm sorry. So the sensitivities we project depend heavily on the assumed values of the parameters. If I just flip back a bit, you know, there are good scenarios, say where there's no overlap between the ellipses and the two hierarchies, and then there are bad scenarios or tougher scenarios where it's harder to figure out which hierarchy you're in and therefore anything at all much about the CP violating phase except for the fact that it's non-trivial perhaps. So these sensitivities do depend, oh, this is working now. Okay, that's why. Boat woke up. Depend on the sensitivity. So we've chosen a scenario, a set of parameters that illustrates the capabilities on all questions, including, for example, whether or not we can exclude maximal mixing. Of course, if it truly were maximal, then we wouldn't be able to do that. So it wouldn't be much fun to show that sensitivity. So we have a parameter set that's about one sigma from our current best fit point. So I don't know, maybe when you look at these, you want to subtract the sigma and quadrature to reflect that. So this is for delta CP, 3 pi over 2, not too far from the 1.2 that we had, 1.2 pi. The value of sine squared theta 2, 3, we've chosen in the lower octant, kind of about a sigma away from the best fit bit less than a signal away from the best fit if we choose the lower octane.
Hey, Peter, sorry to interrupt, but the Zoom slides are not changing. If you're on other than slide 15, we can't tell.
No, I'm on slide 15.
Are you? Okay.
But it still may be broken. Hold on a second. Did that change?
Yeah,
that changed. Okay.
I'm monitoring it.
So, yeah, the problem is not with Zoom.
Fair enough.
So as we go out in time, you see that in this scenario, we can get to 2 sigma in CP violation, 2 sigma sensitivity, 2 sigma exclusion of CP conservation at around 2021 or 2022. Similarly, for determining the octant, the higher RT, we would actually get to 3 sigma before 2021, and then actually make it out almost to 4 sigma here by the end of the run. And maximum mixing is kind of well above 3 sigma there too. sorry, I just point out that CP violation would end up less than 3 sigma. In the older versions of this we showed, we had a scenario, we were a bit further away from maximum mixing, lower theta 2-3 actually helps in NOVA, the determination of CP violation. So that used to just about touch 3 sigma, and it doesn't do that anymore. So there are other scenarios that are compatible with the data that have better or worse sensitivity to the mass hierarchy, octant, and maximality, but generally they tend to be weaker for CP violation. The one I just mentioned is now further away from our data since our latest result came back closer to maximal mixing. Okay, so now on to T to K. So T to K is also a long baseline neutrino oscillation experiment with a beam of muon neutrinos looking for muon neutrino survival and new E appearance. Their far detector is Super Kamiokande. That's at a baseline of 295 kilometers and just a... Oh, and the software updates are back too. Sorry. There's almost nowhere you can put this cursor without getting some notice. So on the left is a muon neutrino charge current event, which you can distinguish from the nice sharp outline of the Cherenkov ring. And then an electron neutrino charge current event, the electron ring, has a bit of a fuzzier outline. So that's the essence of how they do that. Separate those, and they've gotten a lot more sophisticated over the last few years, bringing in more samples. So these are their most recent results presented last summer, where they have 14 10 to the 20 protons on target in neutrino mode and 7 10 to the 20 protons on target in anti-neutrino mode. So this was their first result combining neutrino and anti-neutrino data. And you see the various data sets. So this is muon neutrino candidates, and then electron neutrino candidates over here on the right. And then the top row here is neutrino data. The bottom row is anti-neutrino. It's really anti-neutrino mode and neutrino mode. And they do have a larger background of wrong sign contamination than we do, mainly due to the energy. They operate at a lower energy. Okay. So this is the result of their so-called atmospheric parameter contours now, and they are their contour is a bit narrower than ours. The central value is the contours overlap quite well between NOVA and T to K. They are also compatible with maximal mixing. They have a very weak preference for the upper octant. Similar to us. CP conservation now is disfavored at 2 sigma. So this is the significance contours as a function of delta CP for the normal and inverted hierarchy. And you see that the CP conserving values of minus pi, we go from 0 to 2 pi, they go from minus pi to pi. The CP conserving values of minus pi and 0 are now, their significance is above the 2 sigma critical level. So they are declaring that they disfavor CP conservation 2 sigma. And interestingly, their mass hierarchy, the inverted hierarchy contour also seems to just about be disappearing. The bit of it below their 2 sigma critical value here seems to be almost disappearing, but they do not make a claim of significance there on the mass hierarchy. Okay, so TDK has a proposal for the future, TDK 2. So the essence is to go from the approved 78 10 to the 20 protons on target to 200 10 to the 20. Beam upgrades to 1.3 megawatts and running through 2026. They might achieve this by 2025 if they get more running than they've traditionally gotten or that is currently planned per year. There's a variety of beam upgrades that they would do and other beam and analysis improvements and a reduction of systematic uncertainties, modest and achievable. The analysis improvements, they've also, like Nova, have realized some of those already and being a bit more aggressive with their fiducial volume, getting larger data sample that they trust now. So this is, on the left here, is their delta chi-squared for excluding CP conservation as a function of delta CP for different scenarios of sine squared theta 2, 3. The solid lines here are the full 200 10 to the 20 protons on target, and you see they would get above 3 sigma for each of those, basically, with that full data set. We don't go out that far, but if you map this onto the plot I showed you earlier, this is a little bit of a, you know, comes with a caveat that we've pulled these numbers off of some combination of plots of theirs, that they might not get the exact same answer for their result as we do. But it follows NOVA, actually, in a very similar scenario quite well. They happen to use 0.43 for the mixing sine squared of theta 2,3. There are other potential mass hierarchy measurements out there. There's JUNO, medium baseline reactor measurement, where they have a diabase style detector 50 kilometers from new 36 gigawatt reactor complex, which is also isolated from other reactors. Okay. And so they basically use the interference between the, I didn't mean to write atmospheric here, but it kind of works anyway, between the two fast oscillation components. And sorry, that's pretty small print, but in principle, you can distinguish the two hierarchies by doing a fit to those two, well, to what you actually observe. And there's a challenge there of calibration linearity, but they are focused on that. And they say they will get 3 sigma by 2022 or 2023, and they seem to be on track there and plowing ahead. There's ORCA KM3NET, which is an underwater atmospheric neutrino experiment. They also say they would get 3 sigma sensitivity in 3 years for a variety of scenarios, possibly by 2025. I'm trying to piece together. This is where the prognostication spectrum goes to the wrong side a bit. I don't have any privileged information except they're looking for full funding kind of in about 2 years from now to build more of their optical modules and deploy them. So their access to the mass hierarchy comes through basically the matter effects, both in electron neutrinos and in muon neutrinos. And as a function of angle and energy, they will get different event rates depending on whether you have inverted or normal mass hierarchy. Okay, so Louise asked me to talk a little bit about what we will know, what we know we will know in the future. I think the audience here is pretty well familiar with Dune, probably more than me in a way, because I've been busy with NOVA. Of course, we know the idea is to have a 1.2 megawatt beam upgradable to 2.4 megawatts with a wideband flux, near and far detectors, but the baseline here is 1,300 kilometers, which enhances the matter effect, gives you more sensitivity to the mass hierarchy, along, of course, with the fancier detector, 40 kilotons of liquid argon TPC, deployed in a staged way, starting with 20 kilotons in 2026. And I believe all the plots I show take that staging into account, or at least most of them do. So it's an amazing level of statistics, 1,000 new e-appearance events in 7 years. So these are the Dune mass hierarchy reach plots. So this is the square root of the chi-squared, call it sigma if you want, as a function of delta CP in 7 years and 10 years for the inverted and normal hierarchy. And in all of these cases, they do better than 5 sigma in 7 years. And then if you look at TP violation, these plots show, sorry, I'm having trouble reading the legend myself here, and I'm standing next to it, but for 50% of delta CP value, this shows the significance you would have of rejecting CP conservation for 50% of CP values as a function of years. So you would get kind of equal odds, that's 50-50 here, this color, at around 5 years. And then I'll say call it a high chance of observing CP violation at 3 sigma after 12 years, because this darker green here is 75% of delta CP values. Of course, you know, that's assuming a flat prior, to put it that way. Okay, SBN, briefly. sorry, I did not mean to leave off a particular detector here. I'm sure that's fine. actually, I didn't mean to put either of these two there. They're in the caption. So, of course, we have Microboon, which has been taking data. So this program will be a world-leading neutrino oscillation search scale, delta M squared of an electron volt squared. Microboon has been taking data since 2015. Icarus, as we know, is on site. And they expect installation this summer and ready for filling with liquid argon and commissioning, according to the technically driven schedule, next year. And SBND, TPC assembly is supposed to start this summer. Electronics production fall, completion of the cryostat, and then start cryostat and detector installation in 2019. So just some plots from the proposal. This is what they would have in the three detectors for electron neutrino candidates. Where the white here, the gap, the top white histogram here is what you would get at the central value of the global best fit of COP et al. And this shows after 3 years in the lower left, the excuse me, the sensitivity to the electron neutrino appearance. And the five sigma line is the boy, is that the really faint one you just get to see on this? Yeah. So it still, you know, almost entirely excludes this 90% region of COP et al., but there are other regions of, say, LS&D where it's not quite really ruled out. And it shows just the reach they would have also over here in the disappearance sensitivity. So I'm saying by 2022, 2023, you could have a definitive answer to the existence of EV scale effects. Okay. Maybe really quickly I could say a word or two about, well, actually, I was going to come back to this last, so I was going to say just a couple words about neutrinoless double beta decay. So, of course, if neutrinos are Majorana particles, then you can have neutrinoless double beta decay. This is a violation of total lepton number. And it it also is a process that creates only matter in this case, right? There's no compensating antimatter production here. The principle, well, first a little bit to the relating the physics to the experiments. So you can relate the expression for the half-life you would expect for this process is a phase space factor times the effective neutrino mass m beta beta, which is this combination of the masses with the mixing elements and the Majorana phases, and these nuclear matrix elements m, which are known to about a factor of 2. I'd say they are the NME of precise calculations. so the m beta beta I'm struggling here to talk about this. So if you have the inverted hierarchy, you would detect you would detect at a higher m beta beta in principle if it exists than you would for the normal hierarchy. So if there is this process, the inverted hierarchy would lead to a quicker discovery. Unless it's up here, but this is mostly on the edge of being disfavored here. The principle of the measurements is to extract this monochromatic signal of 2 electrons out near the Q beta beta here. but they've greatly exaggerated this peak. And if you look at the inset, it's more the natural normalization where you have the traditional two neutrino beta-beta risking swamping that signal. So the idea of the experiments here is to get either the best energy resolution, or, you know, get the best energy resolution you can, and or a higher mass. Those two things can trade off of each other. And just talk briefly about Kan Lan Zen, who has the best limits to date in M beta beta. They have xenon 136 in a nylon balloon. They don't have the best resolution, but they do have a huge mass. And that was with a 383 kilogram source mass there. And then the next step, which is a little bit delayed, is 800 kilograms. And then beyond that, they would go to 1,000. And these are the comments from a talk that was given here back in November, that they are, with the current result, they're close to the inverted hierarchy region. And then this slightly delayed one would enter it. And then their long-term goal would cover most of that region. So maybe just I'll zip ahead here to just this to wrap up. So I'm making this timeline where I'm trying to indicate that I really can't see very far out here to the right. But by the first checkpoint in time, I was asked to talk about, we expect possible three or greater sigma mass determination of the mass hierarchy from several experiments and, importantly, several independent methods. We could possibly get to two or three sigma CP violation observation from two experiments, possible three sigma octant determination, hopefully a definitive answer to the electron volt scale neutrino, and starting to probe the inverted hierarchy for in neutrinoless double beta decay. And I didn't get into the absolute mass measurements like Catrine, but Catrine is working towards, they're starting this year their tritium run, where they hope to eventually get to 200 MeV mass sensitivity. And then kind of looking ahead, with Dune, of course, it looks like we will have five sigma mass hierarchy determination kind of by around 2030 or a little bit later now. Probable three sigma CP violation observation. And then going beyond that, we get to likely three sigma CP violation. And likely, I'm borrowing specifically a phrase from one of Agostini's papers, we're likely to discover neutrinoless double beta decay if we're in the inverted hierarchy. But of course, the long baseline data is saying we're not likely in the inverted hierarchy. So, sorry for going so long.
So we have 5 minutes probably for comments or discussion if anybody has anything that they wanted to bring up.
Fermilab is involved in a sense in neutrino physics at CERN. CMS is looking for heavy neutral leptons. If they are discovered, that will, of course, be extremely interesting and can be used, for example, to settle the Majorana versus Dirac issue. Is it imagined that that should be included in this exercise, or is this exercise, by definition, supposed to exclude that?
That might be more a question for the leaders of the SAC working group, but first I'll say if I had had another 2 weeks, I would have definitely commented on that. So it's not on my part a desire to not include things like that. But,
go ahead, Peter.
I was just going to say the charter of the SAC is to apprise the director of developments in the field. So I would think in that spirit.
Other comments?
I can agree. I can just follow up as for the organizers. Yeah, I mean, this is supposed to be generally planning for the future, not just, sure, it is somewhat more Fermilab centric because we're here, but it's, overall the long reaching, what should the neutrino community do going into the next P5, and also taking into consideration the input into the European planning process, which is going on at the moment. Yes, 100%, that should be.
So. comments in remote as well? All right. So what about more exotic stuff, such as neutrino magnetic moments, probed through coherent neutrino scattering, maybe? Prospects for neutral current, sterile searches, things like that.
Yeah, I mentioned that I wasn't, you know, didn't really have time to cover that, but certainly there's you can look at that generically. So, you know, I said NOVA is not particularly competitive, you know, in the specifically in terms of producing limits on the 3+1 mixing angles, the theta 2-4 and theta 3-4. Honestly, yeah. But you can just ask the question. With what precision can we test just the appearance of neutral current for neutrinos and antineutrinos, or just neutrinos at the far detector compared to neutrinos at the near detector? And we should be able to do that measurement in NOVA to about 6% by 2022, a little bit better beyond that. So, you know, I'm not tying that to a specific model, but it is the current longest baseline experiment in the world, and it's definitely the kind of thing we should look for.
Okay, let me just make a small comment. It is extremely important to talk about the specific model because that tells us the specific signature we would look at, right? For instance, the magnetic moment is actually not affected by the coherent scattering because it couples to dipole. So it has a gamma 5, if you want, or a sigma mu nu on it. But the point is that you would like to see that on electron scattering. And you don't want to do neutral current for electron scattering and so on, right? So my only point is that the model is extremely important because different models will give you different signatures and we might actually get new ideas to
sure, but to apply when you have an existing experiment, it's also important to go ahead and
yes.
The facility you have to
yes, of course.
Measure everything that hasn't been measured before. And we do have analysis for anomalous magnetic moment in our near detector. I don't know how far it'll go. We have had a limit that somebody's graduated on, but I can't say much right now about the future evolution.
Okay. So if you have additional comments or anything like that, either send them to the mailing list where this has been that was circulated in the email, or email Zarco, Louise, and I. Next up, we'll have Stephen telling us about the theoretical perspective at 2026.
Maybe I shouldn't have my phone in the same pocket. Is this on? I tried to give this talk to Pedro, but he wouldn't bite. So, talking about the theoretical aspects of the neutrino in 2025 plus, I brought my crystal ball that lets me see what we're going to be doing as theorists in 2026. It's a black, solidly black ball. Look, you know, the opacity is zero. So, having said that, nearly everything I'm going to say is probably wrong. And that's an embarrassment. It's the everything part that makes it an embarrassment. Not that it's something I say is wrong. Okay, so let me attempt to go through this. I can make any of this. There we are. So neutrinos are everywhere. There are 300 per cubic centimeter from the Big Bang. A supernova emits 10 to the 58. The sun produces 10 to the 38 per second. Why is this so far off to the wrong side?
Steven, it's because it was full screen. Match the projector. Got to take
it out. Yeah, that's why we didn't have it full screen
for
the last one.
All right, okay, fine.
That's okay. It's 10 to the 38 neutrinos per second. Even Dia Bay produces 3 10 to the 21 antineutrinos per second. And except for the very highest energy ones, they last forever. they might decay into the lowest mass eigenstate, but they last forever. So the number of neutrinos in the universe is increasing. Now, most of us think about neutrinos in terms of the flavor states or the interaction states, okay? But in terms of the fraction of time a neutrino spends in these states, it's 1 picosecond in their rest frame. By 1 picosecond, they've gone from one flavor to another, and this is a small fraction of the age of the universe. The neutrino mass eigenstates are best labeled in terms of the electron neutrino content, most, middle, least. And our goal is to understand these mass eigenstates in terms of when we want to know their masses, the mass ordering, and the flavor content. We know the electron neutrino flavor content pretty well, but we're doing very poorly on the muon and tau neutrino flavor content. The electron neutrino content comes mainly from these experiments. The muon content from the long baseline accelerator experiments, and the tau neutrino we get mainly from unitarity. Imposing unitarity on the mixing matrix gives us nearly all the information on the tau. We get a little bit of information from super K, and how many events in OPERA? Five? And there's some information from Ice Cube. The fraction of muon and tau in these mass eigenstates, nu3, is controlled by theta 2-3 here, and for nu1 and nu2, it's controlled by the CP violating phase and theta 2-3, and it's approximately equal in size. If you allow theta 2-3 to vary by the maximum amount from experiment, that's equivalent to varying delta by from 0 to 2 pi. So we don't know these two very well at all, as I'll show you in a moment. So the interaction states, for interactions, it's very simple to talk about electron, muon, or tau. But whenever you talk about an electron, muon, or tau neutrino, you should remember it just interacted within 1 picosecond in its rest frame. Otherwise, it's not an electron, muon, or tau anymore. The states that propagate in time, simply, are the propagation states, and there's a mass matrix, a mixing matrix between the two of them. And the questions that we have to answer, is this matrix unitary? And I'll talk about that in a moment. And what about the masses? Okay. We all know about the mixing matrix and the various ways that you can write it. All I want to say is I have chosen my definition of 1, 2, and 3 so that the ordering of this first row is UE1 squared is bigger than UE2 squared is bigger than UE3 squared. That's my definition of 1, 2, and 3. It's consistent with what other people do in terms of masses, but it's a lot easier to explain. All right, the solar mass ordering, where the nu 1 is above or below nu 2, was solved by Snow in 2003, 4, I can't remember, that order of magnitude. And so there's only one ordering of 1 and 2 that we can have, and it's this ordering, that the state with the more electron neutrino has a lower mass than the state with the not so much neutrino, and the mass ordering that Nova is going to solve for us by the summer, I'm hoping. Neutrino 2018, right? Heidelberg, is whether the state nu 3 is above this pair or below this pair. Okay? I don't know what happened here. All right, so Nova can tell us about the mass ordering. The only reason the T to K can say something about the mass ordering is they're allowed, their point at the moment is outside the allowed region. And if that remains there, it's the most exciting thing that's happened in neutrino physics for a very long time. It's even more exciting than theta 1-3. It probably is not going to remain out there, but it is something that is not mentioned very often. But you should be aware that the standard paradigm is excluded by T2K at around 1 sigma. It's something to watch. All right. So we can talk about the octant of theta 2-3. Peter talked about that. And that tells me whether the new 3 state is dominated by muon or dominated by tau neutrinos. And then for the other 2 states, it depends not only on theta 2-3, but on the CP violating phase. And it has to be an even function of the CP violating phase, or otherwise we get a different answer for neutrinos and anti-neutrinos, and that would violate CPT, and that would be way too exciting. All right, so if delta is plus or minus pi over 2, then this is what happens to the variation of the muon and tau content of these mass eigenstates. There's some variation depending on theta 2-3, but if I go to 0 or pi, the variation becomes quite large. And in fact, if you look for these two, if you look at the variation in nu 2 from tau to here, the variation is enormous. And if you want to know the variation in nu 1, if you go from here, what do I have to click?
Yeah, it's on the screen.
Did that get it?
Yeah.
Yeah. If I go from here to here in nu 2, you see the muon content down here is very small, and up here it's very large. Okay? But it does seem, to some level, that nature is choosing a point that is very close to being symmetric in mu and tau. And of course, that piques the interest of theorists. There appears to be a symmetry. Okay? And so we are going to know how close to this symmetric point we really are. All right, so what I'm going to talk about now is why do we need precision in these measurements? After all, if you go and ask a theorist, are neutrinos Majorana or Dirac? 3 sigma of them are going to say, oh, they're clearly Majorana. That's not a proof. If you ask neutrino theorists, is CP violated in the neutrino sector? They're going to say, of course it's violated. Because for it not to be violated, the CP violating phase has to be 0 or pi. And that's such a small part of the phase space. It's an infinitesimal part of the phase space. But that's not a proof either. We have to measure these things, and we have to measure them with precision. So I'm going to give you 4 arguments why I want to know these parameters with precision. And we will not know that by 2025. The nice thing, oh, there is a clock in this room. Wonderful. All right. So to discover neutrino beyond the standard model physics, we need to precision predictions for the neutrino standard model. That should be no surprise to anybody who's ever gone to a physics seminar in this room. CDF saw the forward-backward asymmetry in the top quarks was not in agreement with the standard model. That's because the theorists hadn't calculated it correctly, and the measurement hadn't been done correctly. That's why I can pick on this one, because I can pick on both. Because it was a combination of those two facts that have to come together. So even though the theorists wrote 200 papers on this problem, it turned out to be just standard model physics. So we want to be able to see standard model physics in the neutrino sector. We have to have firm predictions for the neutrino standard model. So the first one I'm going to talk about is determining the Faber fractions of the neutrino mass eigenstates. I talked about them earlier. Well, why do you care? Well, I can tell you
Ice Cube cares.
If I take a muon, a mass eigenstate nu1 neutrino, and I scatter it to form a muon, that's very similar to the process of a top quark scattering into a decaying into a W plus and a down type quark. And the rates are proportional to the square of the appropriate CKM matrix. All right? For leptons, we don't know this U mu 1 squared to within a factor of 3 at the current time. That's not a very good prediction. In the quark sector, it's very interesting. In the quark sector, there is only one element whose square depends on the CP violating phase, and that is VTB. All the other elements, the CP violating piece, either comes out the front, which you can do for one element, or it's suppressed by higher powers of lambda compared to the leading term. All right? So in the quark sector, VTD is squared is 10 to the minus 4, all right? But it has some CP violating dependence. But the CP violating dependence is on the 20 or 30% level. So the reason that the Ice Cube cares about this is that the flavor content and their flavor triangle of nu1, nu2, and nu3, this includes delta theta 2, 3 uncertainty, are these large regions. All right? If you get rid of the theta 2's dependence, then it's much, much smaller. But you can still see the dependence on the CP violating phase. Nu3, of course, has no CP violation phase because it factors out the front. That's a convention, by the way. So to make a firm prediction about where these high-energy neutrinos should sit in this plot, you have to know the parameters of our model with some better precision than we currently do. So here is what the allowed region is. So we can do much better than that if we know theta 2, 3, and we know delta. Stress tests of the neutrino standard model. In the quark sector, we've done an infinite number of experiments on measuring this, the CK, the unitarity triangle. And this triangle, I'm sorry, it's very small here, but this triangle is usually got units of 1, but remember it's multiplied by lambda cubed, where lambda is 0.2. Okay, so this is a zoom in of what's happening. In the neutrino sector, if you look at what the closure of the unitarity triangles is, there's only one that we know relatively well, and that's the electron muon triangle. And all the others we don't know even at the 10% level.
Sir, what is...
What?
Sorry, what are you plotting exactly?
What am I plotting? Oh, yeah. This is the residue of the unitarity triangle for both the rows and the columns. I'm sorry. It looks so good on my Mac screen.
Everything does.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me what the ticks are? The major ticks? Like the,
oh, these things.
No. I mean the x-axis.
That's the 0.5, values. 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2. Okay? Sorry, and this is the chi-squared. So this is 3 sigma is at the top. Okay? So you can see that most of the unitarity triangles, we The closure is at the 10% level. Except for the EMU triangle, where the closure is down at the 2 or 3% level, and this is just where the LS&D data comes in. Okay, remember you've got to square this to get the rate for LS&D. Okay, and the triangle and the normalizations, so this is the same plot, but for the rows and the columns, this is 1 minus the contribution from the rows. So if there is unitarity, this should be 0. And it's only the mu and the electron row that we have any real knowledge of, because all the other row is the tau row, which is hopeless, and the other columns all have the tau in them. So the point I'm making here is that 9 out of the 12 involve the new tau. Okay. All right. There's also non-standard interactions that we should consider, but I'm going to move on. There's a connection to leptogenesis, and here is a model by these people where they parameterize things in terms of two masses, and then theta-1-3 is this red line, delta-m-squared-2-1 is the yellow line, and delta-m-squared-3-1 is the blue line, and they fit. And if they didn't fit, of course, they wouldn't have written this paper. But it is interesting that they do fit. All right. So the other thing is to test the theoretical neutrino models. So here is, if you make a test of various predictions versus cosine delta, all right, and this is the likelihood, all right, and obviously you can't distinguish whatever these models are. It doesn't matter what they are. You can see them on your screen. But you can see that you can't distinguish between these models at the current time because our knowledge of cosine delta, sorry, this is the prediction of cosine delta using the other parameters in the model, okay, that you get from experiment, like theta 1, 2, theta 2, 3, theta 1, 3. And if you increase the precision on those measurements, then this is what you would get for the same set of models. So you can now start to see when cosine delta gets measured, you can say that, well, it's near 0.5, so you've eliminated all of these models. But if it was 0.5 over here, yeah, you've eliminated 2 maybe. All right, so there's 4 reasons why I want to measure the parameters of this model with precision. It's for things like Ice Cube to discover new physics, check the unitarity triangle, predictions for the models, and the connection to leptogenesis. So I want to say a few more words about light sterile neutrinos, because we might even learn something about light sterile neutrinos in the time period between now and 2025. If I embed the standard model in a larger neutrino model with sterile neutrinos, there is a constraint called the Cauchy-Schwarz constraint that constrains the elements of this submatrix. Okay? It comes from the constraint on the whole matrix, but the whole matrix has to be unitary. This part of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality is related to muon disappearance. That's going to be measured out here in SBN program. All right? This is electron disappearance. And that's been tested to some extent by Diabe, Reno, and a number of 10-meter reactor experiments. And then this piece is the appearance experiment. Microboon, Icarus. And you can also get some other information from some of these other experiments. So by 2025, we should have either confirmed that there's a sterile neutrino or ruled it out. So what do we do then? there are two things we need to do. One is, if we've confirmed it, the question is, what's the size of CP violation? Because there is sterile, if there is a sterile neutrino, there is CP violation at a different scale, at a different length scale than the one that Dune is going to explore. And Dune can explore this one, but it's not the optimal experiment. So what is the optimal experiment? Okay? The other question is, suppose we rule out the sterile neutrino. We have only ruled it out in the electron and the muon flavor. It could be coupled purely only to taus. All right? There's nothing wrong with that. So we have to constrain the tau component. And the constraints on the tau component in a sterile neutrino at the present time, as Peter mentioned earlier, are not that good. All right. So the other thing we should say, I should say a little bit about, is cosmology should put a constraint on the sum of the neutrino masses that starts to become interesting by the time 2025. I mean, at the moment, they're at around, 200 millielectron volts. And we know that if the neutrinos are in the normal ordering, in the inverted ordering, the sum of the neutrino masses has to be 100 millielectron volts. Okay? So as these march down, get smaller and smaller, that becomes interesting. The question is going to be, suppose they rule out the inverted ordering, but don't see they can't rule out zero neutrino mass. Are you going to believe that? Right? My personal opinion is no. Because if you can't rule out zero, I'm not going to believe that you could rule out 100. All right? That's my personal opinion, but I'm sure that we could have a lot of discussion with the cosmologists about that. And then there is a question about the software issue. Then there's a question about the number of light degrees of freedom, which is now already fairly tightly constrained by the Planck experiment to be not much bigger than 3. But of course, this makes the assumption that that fourth neutrino, or relativistic mass eigenstate, relativistic state, was thermalized in the early universe. So people can get around that by making these things so that they don't thermalize in the early universe. But the sum of the neutrino masses is there. All right. So the reactor experiments, going forward to 2025, there will be the Juno experiment, which will make wonderful measurements on sine squared theta 1-2, delta m squared 2-1, and delta m squared EE at about the 0.5% level. Okay? Now, you should be aware that there is some tension in delta m squared 2-1 between Camland and all the solar experiments. Now, I don't know that it's... I mean, the Camland experiment has very small error bars, and the solar experiments have quite large error bars, but there is some tension there. So since Camland is a single experiment, if a single experiment measures something, I would like to have it confirmed by another experiment at approximately the same precision. Maybe the reason that the T to K is seeing something outside the allowed region is they're using the wrong delta M squared 2-1. If I just say a priori, Camland is wrong, then I can explain that. Of course, I've got to defend why Camland is wrong. It probably isn't, but we should, as physicists, check that. And that this experiment will do these wonderful measurements. They also claim to be able to do the mass ordering. And the mass ordering depends on being able to reconstruct the neutrino energy to better than, I would say, 0.5%. What they have here, what is shown here, is if the reconstructed neutrino energy varies from the true energy by 2%, I've changed an inverted ordering into a normal ordering. If I just happen to be on this curve. All right? But what happens if I change it from a normal ordering to something that is middle, something halfway in between normal ordering and inverted ordering? Then I don't know what I'm doing. Well, that cuts this down by a half. And then you could ask the question, why do they assume it's exactly correct out here? Why not push this whole thing down a little bit? And that gets you to 0.5%. So for this experiment to work, you have to be convinced that they can measure and reconstruct the neutrino energy to within 0.5%. I think Nova would be very excited if it could do that. Okay. So I'm skeptical, but I could be proven wrong. I'd love to be proven wrong. We did talk about neutrinoless double beta decay, so I will go quickly on this. And yes, by 2025, we will be probing probably down here somewhere. I just want to say that some people get very concerned about this trench down here. To be in this trench, you have to have three parameters that are related to one another at the 1% level to get into that trench. Okay? They're all related. So if you take a three-dimensional volume of these three parameters and you draw a string through it, you have to be on that string. And there's no reason that would happen. And so if I was, I would say the minimum that you can get for M beta beta is around this 10 to the minus 4 millielectron volts. And then this is what this to the curve looks like if you start putting impinging in it the results from cosmology. So let me say a few words about non-neutrino physics, QCD, and nuclear physics. The neutrino only provides the W or the Z. And then everything else is QCD, strong interaction. And that impacts things like the reactor flux and spectrum. Okay? And I would say I don't think we've done very well on that. As you saw in Peter's talk, the matrix elements for neutrinoless double beta K have a factor of 2 uncertainty in them. And we've had an infinite number of talks on cross-sections for neutrino nucleon and nuclear scattering. By 2025, if I was looking at my crystal squash ball, yeah, this is the squash ball, I would say there will be incremental improvements. But I don't know that we're going to actually solve this problem as theorists. We might be able to solve the neutrino nucleon scattering problem using lattice QCD. But everything else depends on real serious nuclear physics. Now, the problem in nuclear physics is that the shell model works far too well. The shell model is a model in which the nucleons are free, sitting in a bath of a potential caused by the other nucleons. It's a very naive model, and it works damn well. given how naive it is, but it's not good enough for doing these things. All right. So I should say a little bit about theory. Pedro gave this wonderful talk at DPF, and he talked about how neutrinos are a portal to new physics in all sorts of different ways. And then there was a whole set of subjects that he didn't even talk about. Theorists are extremely creative. We need to be constrained. Okay. One of these constraints is going to lead to a new surprise in neutrino physics. Unfortunately, I don't know which one it is. Otherwise, it would be clear what I would be doing. All right, so we've made tremendous progress on understanding the neutrino since neutrino 1998, the masses and the mixings, okay? And hopefully by 2025, we will know the neutrino mass ordering at, say, 3 sigma. Here's an interesting question. At what point is the community going to say, oh, we know the mass ordering? Is it 2 sigma? 3 sigma? 5 sigma? I don't know. I at some point the community is just going to say, oh, that's an old problem. We don't care. Okay? Sorry. What is the dominant flavor in Nu 3? And then what is the size of the CP violating phase and its uncertainty? By 2025, the uncertainty on the CP violating phase, if it was 90 degrees, is probably going to be 20 or 30 degrees. That's roughly what I would guess. I mean, we can argue a little bit, but it's on that, it's between 20 and 30. Maybe even a little more. We would like to be able to pin it down much better than that, and that's what the program of Dune will do. The unitarity of the matrix I talked about, we're only really going to do 3 of the 12 possible tests because we don't have access to the taus. So that is bothersome. It would be like looking at the standard model and not being able to look at the top and the bottom quarks. All right. As I said, LS&D sterile neutrinos should be either confirmed, then we'll be looking for CP violation, or ruled out. Neutrinos double bro decay will be probing below the below or at the inverted ordering scale. We will understand a great deal more about oscillations, decoherence, leptogenesis, etc. Will we have a convincing model of neutrinos and masses, mixings of masses, with testable confirmed predictions? I hope so. I hope I write that paper. But, you know, it's going to be tough. It's a tough problem. And what about the connections to other sectors? I mean, the neutrino mass and mixing cannot be independent of everything else in the standard model or in physics. There may be some portal to some other sector. And of course, there's one thing theorists love, and that's the next item, surprises. Because surprises are what drive us in this field. This is how the young person in the back row gets to write the paper that wins the Nobel Prize. Because the old people are too stuck in their own corner. All right? So where are the surprises? Both in theory and in experiment. All right, thank you. Oh, I have one quote I want to share with you by Isaac Asimov in his book. And I think we'd all agree on that.
So, Stephen, if I understand, that you showed us models that
predicted cos theta in terms of other
angles,
angles.
Yeah. And masses.
And there were five or six of them, and none of them were anywhere near CP conserving. Is that a bias or?
Yes, because a lot of these models are related to what happens in the quark sector. They're connected to what happens in the quark sector. And we know in the quark sector, CP violation, I don't know, what, 69 degrees? Is that right? Yeah, I mean, it's very close to 70 degrees. So that's why, because of this connection, they all have CP violations.
But nothing else, you know, no other feature seems to come over from the quark sector, so. No other, you know, feature of the parameters.
Well, these models are... That particular set of models is, I would say, is somewhat contrived. But I was giving that as an example. If, you know, if somebody had a good model, you would like to test to see whether it fit. And if you don't have the measurement, cosine delta, as you well know, is going to be a particularly tough measurement for you guys, for even Dune, if it's 90 degrees. Excluding CP violation will be a piece of cake. But then measuring the angle will not be so good. I mean, let's face it, if CP violation is 10 degrees and I measure it to 2 or 3, then you ruled out CP conservation. But if it's 90 degrees and the uncertainty is 20 degrees, I've still ruled out CP violation. Yeah.
I've had a related question for a long time. What if... CP violation is not detected and the corresponding angle that's extracted is, or CP violating phase is, you know, within 2 or 3 degrees of CP conserving. Does that start to be interesting or exciting to theorists? Or at what level of precision would that be an interesting observation?
Well, for theorists, in terms of just the model, Every CP violating degree is the same as any other one, all right? Because it's just a continuum, 0 to 2 pi. We have no preference. Now, we have a preference that we want to have CP violation, but it would put a constraint on our model, and it would have implications for leptogenesis, some models of leptogenesis. But
to carry it to an absurd degree, let's say... CP or the CP violating phase was measured to be 0 plus or minus a degree. Would that stand out as something particularly?
That actually is more surprising and would probably be more interesting than 79 degrees plus or minus a degree.
So then what about 0 plus or minus 5 or 10? Where's the line where it's the vague fuzzy line where it becomes uninteresting?
It's nature. It's always interesting. I mean, you know, theorists thirst for knowledge, to know things, to make implications for other things, right? I'm sure people would... Pedro's got a comment.
Yeah, it's a small thing, just...
So if delta seems to be like 0, for instance, or pi, that, as Stephen said, is super interesting. Now, it points maybe to a symmetry or something, but... It's very difficult to disprove it unless we move outside of it, right? You cannot, I mean, my point being that you cannot prove that there is a symmetry at work, but you can disprove it, right? You can disprove that CP is exactly 0, but you cannot prove it.
Sure.
So the question is a bit tricky in that sense. But as a theorist, I would say the better you get at precision, the better. And since, you know, models of flavor involves quarks and leptons, there is a lot that we need to improve in the neutrino sector to get even close to the quark sector, right? So I would say the better you do there, like the more and more interesting it gets.
All right.
Another parameter with the same situation.
Okay. Any additional questions or comments?
It's the acceleration of the expansion of the parameters.
All right. Next up, Alan Bross will be telling us a little bit about neutrino beams beyond LB and F.
Or not.
Okay, that one fits. Why does mine fit and the others did not?
Oh, you, it's still on full screen.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, I got it. All right. So I was asked to kind of review about 20 years of R&D on non-conventional neutrino sources, and I'll do my best and make an argument or not about whether or not they're actually needed. So it's been 50 years since Van der Meer invented the magnetic horn, and basically we're doing the same damn thing. We hit a target as hard as we can, and we fire now maybe three horns. But that has really not changed in 50 years, although in the interim, there have been neutrino beams that have been quad-focused, sign-selected, and narrow-band. And in fact, tag neutrino beams were proposed and almost built here. That was Bob Bernstein's idea back, I think, in the late 80s. And actually, new R&D is ongoing to actually do that now. And I'll talk about that a little bit. But really, we're basically doing the same thing. So over the past 20 years, the first neutrino factory workshop was in 1999. We tried to develop alternative designs for accelerator-based neutrino beams, and this has been centered around neutrino factory studies. And the motivation is obvious. In fact, the idea of a neutrino factory or neutrino beams born from muons in a storage ring goes back about 45 years. Actually, a paper I found that Dan Green wrote while he was a postgraduate student at Rochester, I think, was the first paper I found. It's a well-understood neutrino source. In fact, it's completely known. So the flavor content is fully known. And with a well-designed decay ring or storage ring, flux determination is near absolute with beam current monitors, polarization, beam divergence monitors, and potentially a muon momentum spectrometer in the arc. So there's a tremendous control of systematic uncertainties, which we have not been able to master in conventional neutrino beams. We've tried hard, and we have not improved the situation very much in the last 10 years. And Zarko, you can comment. I think it's a little disappointing. We've really tried very hard, and maybe that will happen in the next 10 years, but it's a tough road. So in the neutrino factory studies, there have been a lot of them. We've generated a lot of paper and maybe one neutrino. Well, actually, we've generated a lot of neutrinos in the new cool test area because we were hitting the LINAC beam on a beam dump, but not one of those neutrinos was ever detected. And then came P5, and that ended it. So essentially, all the R&D in the U.S. ramped down after the P5 report came out, and in fact, that had an impact outside the United States. The next major biggest player was the U.K., and the program there also ramped down very quickly, too. So we haven't been able to do anything aggressively in the last 4 years. But this is where we wound up in the Muon Accelerator program. And the neutrino factory was always coupled to the Muon Collider. From the very beginning, from the first concepts, it was going to be a step along the way to the energy frontier. And in that context, the front ends are identical. Well, there's a proton driver, which is a high power machine, anywhere from 2 to 4 megawatts. It's a little different for the muon collider because the bunches have to be different, but you can ignore that. But the front end, in terms of targetry, capture, pion decay, bunching, phase rotation, and initial cooling, was the same for both machines. So at this point, you could either go to a neutrino factory, which is accelerating the muons to whatever energy you want. And in this case, where we ended up was 5 GeV. Or you go to a muon collider with a lot more cooling and a lot more acceleration. And facilities up to 10 TeV were studied. And I'll come back to this at the end. The interesting thing to note, neutrino factory is you produce both neutrinos and antineutrinos simultaneously. The mu pluses and mu minuses rotate counterclockwise in the ring out of phase. So what does this mean? You need a detector with good timing. So that has a certain constraint. So we didn't do that. So we did have a staging plan within the MAP program, and the first step was called NuStorm, neutrinos and stored muons. And it's a very conventional facility in the sense that the muons were produced conventionally. We had protons on a conventional target, 120 kilowatts. That was one booster batch.
out of the main injector. 1/6 of stored protons were kicked out at a time and brought on a target, conventional target in Horn system. And then the pions were injected into the decay ring and decayed along this first pass. And then the muons within a certain momentum byte, which is shown here, were then captured and circulated in the beam. So Neustorm gave neutrinos both from muon decay and from pion decay, which was a flash from one turn. So it was a step along the way, but it wasn't really a neutrino factory in that we still required pions of the right energy. And here we injected 5 GeV pions. These are the fluxes that we got. This again, Neustorm was proposed as a short baseline facility at 50 meters and at 2 kilometers. This is the beam you get from U decay and from pi decay. The pi decay beam was actually very interesting. It was essentially very pure, almost no background, because the pions had to go through a chicane before they reached the decay ring, so they're sign selected, and also we suppressed the kaons to a large degree. And we basically, at 2 kilometers, we had this basically monoenergetic beam at 2 GeV. These were the event rates that we got for a 5-year run, assuming I think we assumed 1.2 megawatts at that time, running in that range. 100-ton target, we were thinking of something like microboon. So it's, 5 million charge current electron neutrino events, and you can see all the numbers. This is from the muon decays, and from the pion decays, we had something like 41 million new mu CC events. And we had 10 sigma exclusion of the nominal LSMD minimum event in that 5-year run in a 1 kiloton magnetized iron detector. So that didn't work. And after the P5 report, we started thinking about other possibilities. So we said, well, what if we just forget about the muons, and we just get rid of the ring, but have a sign-selected, momentum-selected pion beam. So we basically took Neustorm, got rid of the arcs, got rid of the return, got rid of this section here, which is the orbit combination section, which allowed the muons to come back while you were pumping in pions, and just basically produce a pion beam, collect it, and then send it down a beam line towards the far detector. So this was the concept. This was an initial design by my postdoc, Al Nguyen, which was a quad-focus beam. That didn't get us very far in terms of intensity. So Jean-Baptiste Lagrange at Imperial, who had worked on FFAGs, came up with a design using this type of lattice. FFAG is for fixed field alternating gradient. We didn't have any alternating gradient. This wasn't an accelerator, but we used the FFAG lattice both for the bend to collect a very large momentum acceptance, 50%, and then inject those pions or pi pluses, depending on the sign selection, into a beam line, not a decay pipe. That was the concept. And we actually, after a few iterations, and you can see this is lattice 13, so it was a number of iterations on the design, we did quite well. So the dotted line is the LBNF Dune 3-horn optimized beam, and the solid is this lattice 13 in Newpil. It's roughly half the number of neutrinos integrated under here. Of course, we cut off the high energy tail, which I think was good. So we lose this bit. We also lost this bit down here, which was less good, because that was around the second oscillation peak. But we did actually quite well in terms of the CP analysis. So this was done by Elizabeth Worcester at BNL under a certain set of rules. So when we proposed this to LBNF management and the spokes, we said, okay, let's do this comparison, but under certain ground rules. And one of the there were a number of ground rules. One was that some of the systematic uncertainties, contamination and whatnot, would be assumed to be the same in both LBNF and Dune. And this is what we got. So it was roughly the same, but not any better. It was a little bit worse. However, if you look hard at the CDR assumptions at the time this was done, some of those assumptions would have been hard to justify in terms of systematic uncertainties assumed. Whereas in Newpil, we had them nailed. And if we actually relaxed that one criterion, we actually would have done better. But the real problem in NuPil design was that we never achieved a good match between the end and the straight. We lost half the pion beam power, about 40 kilowatts in this matching section here. So we threw away half the beam, and then we basically had an enormous energy loss there, which meant that we couldn't get rid of the 40 kilotons of concrete that go into the decay pipe. And that's how we save money. So if we didn't need the decay pipe concrete, we could buy magnets instead. And basically it was a cost neutral design. But with this beam loss, that was not the case. And in fact, that repeated down the decay street. Each one of these represents a quad triplet, and we never had time to fix this. Maybe it's fixable, maybe it's not. We didn't have the opportunity, but that's where that ended. And then there was NuPil Light. This is Millerad's idea, which was just to have a sign-selected, momentum-selected bend in the target station, utilizing two dipoles and the same three-horn system. And that didn't really catch on either with our LBNF colleagues. It looked a little too dangerous. However, Mary Bashai raised a new twist recently, and she proposed fielding one of these dipoles in the target station and then use it periodically as a calibration, turn it on and use that as a calibration beam for the near detectors in the DUNE experiment. Not run it all the time, but turn it on every now and then to produce a sign-selected narrowband beam to help calibrate the near detectors. We'll see. I don't think that's going to do well either. Because it requires a lot of changes to the LBNF facility, and we all know that train has left the station and it is highly constrained. There is some ongoing R&D. Outside the U.S., there are two things. One is Moment in China, which is to piggyback on the Chinese ADS LINAC development, that's accelerator-driven systems. That's a CW proton LINAC going up to 15 megawatts. So they would take that beam, put it on the target, collect pions, let them decay, and then collect the muons and then aim them towards the detector, which would be Juno. This is a very low energy beam, 100 to 200 MeV. R&D is ongoing. This would be well beyond 2026 if this were available. And then the tag neutrino beam concept has come back again. It's called ENUBET, enhanced neutrino beams from kaon tagging. It's to build a detector capable of performing position identification in KE3 decays while operating in basically a neutrino beam decay tunnel. Relatively low power. Project has been approved by the European Research Council. It's being hosted by INFN. Work is being done at CERN and has a 5-year program. I think that ends in 2021 in terms of producing a feasibility study. This is an old idea. We were going to do it here. There was a proposal to do it here many years ago. And it never got off the ground.
What's the total integrated flux you hope about that?
Protons on target or neutrinos?
No, what's the total number of neutrinos you would actually...
It's something like 1/100th of a conventional neutrino facility on that order.
Okay. You would know
everything about that neutrino.
What do you do with pions?
What do you do with pions?
You put them into a dump.
They will follow the same as K. You can separate them.
Yeah, so that's a potential background, but most of them will hit the dump. Okay. So that's ongoing, and they have a few more years. And in the U.S., you know, our colleagues who are working on pion decay at rest sources. That's Daedalus and Isidar. Daedalus for WCP. That's a 600 MeV. Proton cyclotrons, like going up to 4 megawatts, and that would be paired with Hyper-K in some distant future. And then Isidar is a sterile neutrino search via lithium-8 beta decay, 60 MeV protons onto a lithium target paired with Camland. This is not a neutrino beam per se, 4-pi distribution, low energy implies short baseline, and that's what they're looking at. What these sources can add in the time frame beyond 2026, we'd have to think about. So moving forward, there'd be many good ideas, but the question is, will any of them be needed in 2027?
I'm sorry, previous slide. Why it's better than a nuclear reactor, which produces a lot of neutrinos in the...
Well, for which? For Daedalus or for Isidore?
Which is the plan?
Well, CP violation at reactors you're not going to do. The neutrino search at reactors, yes. The one of the really very nice features of Isidore is the oscillation behavior that it can show you. And that's very powerful. So that beam coupled with Camlan could do some very interesting things, because the Camlan detector is precise enough and large enough that you'd actually see the oscillation within the detector, and that could actually help you define what you're looking at. It's one part of that puzzle.
All right.
So again, I think new pill, it's too late already, or that type of concept of a neoconventional neutrino beam. Bob will tell us a little bit more. New storm, cross sections, I think they'll be done already. I'll tell you why in a second. Steriles, well, maybe they'll be dead already, I don't know. As an R&D prop from Muon Collider, maybe they're dead, I don't know. Neutrino factory, including pion decay at rest sources. That all depends on what known unknowns within the standard neutrino model will still be unknown. And unknown, I mean at 3 sigma. Or surprises. I don't think moment or pion decay at rest themes are likely to add something much in the period beyond 2026. We'll have to see. That would require a surprise. Stepping stone to a muon collider, well, maybe that's dead already, but maybe it's not. So maybe I'm being too pessimistic. Well, I am, yeah, but that's life. I can be pessimistic about the possibilities of the neutrino factor, but I'm not pessimistic about what I think we'll be able to do at Dune, because I think the beam issues we can solve, because that's going to be done at the near detection site. And there, I think we are beginning to make progress on a very powerful near detector suite. This is the one I like. There's someone else standing up here. We'll show a different picture. But this is not Minerva. This is not Minos. This is not Nova. This is even not Nomad. This is an exceedingly powerful near detector system, which is closer to a collider detector system than a neutrino detector. So it's pixelated liquid argon, plus a high-pressure, magnetized high-pressure gas TPC, plus 3D scintillator detector, or 3D is three dimensions. Lost in the end, I think we'd probably add a liquid hydrogen, liquid deuterium TPC, smaller. So 25 tons of liquid argon, that's 64 million cc mu events per year. That's 5,000 neutrino electron elastic events per year. The gas TPC is 1 ton, scales proportionately, and the 3DST is about 5 tons. And we're also considering implementing a Dune prism concept where we could take all or part of the system and move it off axis to get there. So we will get the flux from, and it's all on argon. So this is argon and this is argon. So we're extrapolating to neutrino action reactions on argon to a far detector which is filled with argon. And I think that's the power. And then we add a little bit with the scintillator detector. So gas is synergistic with the liquid because this is really too small to fully contain the events. So we will be able to do analysis of muons and hadrons coming from the liquid. And the 3DST, which would be downstream of the gas TPC most likely, can help us measure neutrons. If we had a technology detector that could measure the neutrons from these neutrino interactions, then we would be golden. Then I'd say, forget it. We've got everything we need to know. We can do it. But we don't have that. And that is the biggest uncertainty we would have on reconstructed neutrino energy in this type of system. But we're beginning to get a handle on that by looking at what happens inside the gas, liquid, and 3DST. So many of the things we thought we needed, new storm and or neutrino factory for, we can do with this very powerful multi-purpose detector, near detector, in terms of parameterizing the LB and F beam. It's hard, but doable. This is when it comes to the known unknowns. I don't say anything about the unknown unknown yet. So what are the game changers? So I think this would be a game changer. SBN and the very short baseline reactor experiments that Stephen talked about discover something beyond the standard neutrino model. Better yet, they both do. They both have four signals, and they don't agree. That would be fantastic, because then NewStorm or a facility like it is the only way we'll be able to unravel it. This will have neutrinos, antineutrinos, and we'll be able to change the energy. I think the pion decay at rest can also contribute, but there they're more limited because of the very nature of the beam. We find something that requires an intense neutrino beam at much higher energy. And I think Stephen alluded to this indirectly. Then we need a neutrino factory. So why is that? Answer from the audience. How is a neutrino factory different from every other neutrino beam that's ever been made? E nu is completely uncorrelated with EP. You don't care. In fact, you know, what we talked about here is normally we use proton drivers, which are not ideal. They're too high in energy. We'd like to go lower. So once you do this, and if you want 5 GeV here, you accelerate to 5 GeV. If you want 100 GeV, you just accelerate to 100 GeV, and you don't really lose any muons. You'll have the same number, 10 to the 21 nu plus and nu minuses per year. There's very little loss once you get to 5 GeV going up. So if you really need a very high energy neutrino source, this is the only way you're going to get it, because we all know what the pion energy distribution looks like when we hit 100 GeV protons on a target. It falls very, very rapidly. So if we need 50 GeV pions, there just aren't many out there unless we resurrect the Tevatron. And I don't think we're going to do that. So that would be a game changer for the neutrino factory, and that would push us in that direction. But it's back. So the muon collider is back. This is from Forbes Online from just almost a year ago today. Of course, this is fake news, but whatever. It's actually a very good article. You should read it. It's from one of our own, someone in our community. It's very well written. And he goes through the arguments. And what I want to show is that this isn't fake news. So this is, you know, David's work, and Vladimir's not here. And this will be presented at IPAC next month. And it's a case for a 14, 7 TeV muon beam, mu plus mu minus, in the lepton, in the LHC tunnel. So why is this interesting? Well, Vladimir has a very nice paper that some people have read, where he has a cost model for accelerators. Not everyone agrees with it, but it's actually very predictive. And he's costed the future circular collider, the Hadron 100 TeV Hadron machine, and it's up here. So that's $30 billion. And the error bars go from 20 to 40. Now this machine, which has the same physics reach, the 14 TeV mu plus, is around, I guess, 8 billion, and it goes from 5 to 12. So this is unaffordable, even at CERN accounting, even maybe worldwide accounting. Maybe worldwide we could do it.
Alan, it does not have the same physics reach with a luminosity.
I'm not going to argue that with you now. Just we can go through that argument. It has an interesting physics reach, and you're not going to build this machine because this is $30 billion in U.S. accounting. So if you put it in CERN accounting, that's $10 billion. And CERN has about $300 million a year to spend. So that'll be a 30 to 40-year campaign to build that machine without technology transformation. So this is also, it would produce a very interesting neutrino beam in these straight sections. So this is the opening angle, and that would be 14 microradians of a 1 TeV neutrino beam. So there's been an enormous amount of work done in the last 20 years on new accelerator-based neutrino sources. Many of the technical challenges of these new facilities have been overcome. And feasibility has been demonstrated for most, if not all, of the subsystems. Their need beyond 2026 timeframe will be physics-driven, and in my opinion, very limited unless there is physics beyond the standard neutrino model. So it comes down to determining what is the correct resource allocation now in order to be prepared for some surprises, you know, beyond 2026. A renewed interest in muon colliders may change the outlook regarding R&D on these sources, however. There is some R&D continues in the US, pion decay rest sources. At CERN, New Storm is in the Physics Beyond Colliders initiative. And as I mentioned, the InuBet program is ongoing. And in China, MOMENT is continuing.
I have a question which has nothing to do with muon colliders. From time to time in the last 20 years, people have been talking about beta beams, and these have has died completely, I guess, in the last few years. Is there any reason to look at it again or not to look at it at all?
There was no advantage.
Well,
There was scientific interest
I would love a world where you have a neutrino factory with a muon source, but if you cannot do that, would there be any interest in looking at...
That's what I meant when there's no advantage. So if you went down that route, at least, well, we could argue, you know, whether those costing models were done correctly, but we didn't see any advantage there. And it was really hard. There were some very, very tricky technical problems with the storage ring for the isotope.
So you spent some time on Dune systematics and how nice the near detector is. So Laura Fields and Paul LeBrun have.
Are you going to talk about?
Or is that?
I was going to talk about hadron production.
Are you going to talk about the muon spectrometer?
No. I thought you would. I would have mentioned that,
because that's really neat. So one other thing which isn't related to muon beams is to just build a neutrino test beam. So we build a mock-up of the target station and just measure the pions coming off directly. So that would solve. That doesn't eliminate everything. It doesn't eliminate targeting.
No, but what it addresses is the Dune near detector can measure the exact neutrino flux at that position. What it can't really compensate for is understanding near over far.
Yes, it can.
Things from, okay.
To a large degree, it can if we go off, especially if we go off back.
Okay, so that's the new PRISM idea that, yeah.
And that now has been decided upon. I think that there are two recommendations that have been now made. One is that a pixelated liquid argon detector has been recommended by the working group, and the hall should be designed in such a way that the new PRISM concept could be implemented. What the other detectors are is still ongoing discussion.
Question over here before you.
Oh, I had two questions. So one is, have people been thinking about, so for the Dune beam, we're going to upgrade to 2.3 megawatts, I think, about thinking specifically besides Dune, what sort of physics program we could build up around a 2.3 megawatt beam, which will sort of be a new capability?
Near or far?
I'm thinking near.
No, this is a pet peeve of mine. In fact, I wrote a policy paper and I gave it to Steve Bryce and he put it in the waste basket. But I think, this is my personal opinion, that the near detector hall is way undersized. That should be a facility for exactly this. It should be the Fermilab Neutrino Observatory, where other experimenters can propose other experiments, complementary or orthogonal to the Dune program, and bringing experiments down there to do them, because it'll be the hottest neutrino beam in the world, and the only one that can go to relatively high energy, because that's not going to happen in Japan, ever.
So my other question, so the beta beam question, and kind of related to the neutrino factory, is whether we need to make a muon, new mu appearance in a new E beam, whether that measurement has physics motivation for us to go after over and above other things. So that's what's missing from the non-tau world.
I don't know. I don't know.
Steven, do you want to comment? You listen?
He's not paying.
There was a question that was posed to you about whether or not it would be interesting to look for muon appearance in a new EV.
Not just whether it's interesting, but where it ranks among
the non-tau,
you know, based beyond 2026. Priorities. You didn't highlight it really, so is it not interesting?
Well, I mean, after you've done mu to E, I mean, it is a cross check for a T violation. CPT, they're related by CPT, but there's batter effects. It's certainly not as interesting as having done it earlier. I mean, I doing it now. I would be much more interested in towels. You know, I really think it's the gaping hole.
Right.
I mean, we know so little about the tau neutrino. How many events have been seen?
Six.
Fingers and toes.
One hand.
Could I ask one last question before you stand down? So in a lot of the designs you were showing for R&D, there was sort of like a natural cap at like 5 megawatts. I didn't see that many things that went over 5 megawatts. Is that set by something that I don't know?
No, actually, that's a good question. It isn't. We thought it might be. But one of the successes of the program, which started with the Neutrino Factory and Noise Glider Collaboration, and then came back, was the liquid mercury jet target experiment at CERN called MERIT. And in the end, they thought the system like that could take power up to, I think it was 80 megawatts. So liquid mercury is icky. Nobody likes it. You know, they did everything they possibly could do to not spill the mercury at CERN. They spilled the mercury at CERN and had to clean it up. So it is an issue. But that particular concept actually proved to be very, very robust in terms of power.
All right. Thank you.
Not a question, more of a... Just a comment, because I guess, Bob, you're not going to talk about heteron production, right?
I am going to talk about heteron.
Okay, well, you're probably not going to talk about what I'm going to talk about. if you are, then we should talk. But anyway, just to make people aware that there is a new experiment underway here at Fermilab in the test beam called the IMFATIC, which is a heteron production experiment. And it's a joint effort between Japan and the U.S. And... we're collecting heteron production data on thin targets for now in the short term. And I'm hoping that it will over time grow into something like the LBNS spectrometer, possibly with Japanese participation. So.
Okay. So that's great news, I guess. I'll try to use this. I know it's tricky here. All right. So I'm one that takes us to dinner. Okay. All right, so a lot of this will be entered just for the record, but I'm not here to contradict anything that's been said. And so even as someone who's spent my entire career with conventional neutrino beams and the protons to feed them, I think there's a LBNF, we have to consider that LBNF may very well be the last conventional long baseline neutrino beam built. And so we have to build it so that it can explore the necessary physics that we need, and it will have some measure of flexibility. But we should go into it with that mindset. This could very well be the last big neutrino beam. It is based on conventional technology that it'll measure it and other experimental measures, CP violation and the mass ordering, and then what we find out there will really determine what happens in the future. So in this talk, I'm gonna talk about some of the neutrino beam features that we know that we deal with today. So this is gonna be entirely conventional beams here, and particularly some of the challenges that we have with the beams that we have now. There are gonna be challenges with LBNF, and that'll take us through 30 years. And if there ever is again a need for these big conventional neutrino beams, then they'll play a role there as well. I'll talk about the beams that we have today and the future possibilities we may have with these. So I guess this all displays at once because it's not PowerPoint. This is a great animation.
Bob, you'd have to go into full screen, I think.
Oh, full screen. Okay, thank you.
But then it's probably going to cut it off.
No, this is a PDF, so it's all...
We can have the PowerPoint if you want.
Okay. Let's not waste anyone's time. The basic, I think a lot of you know what the basics of the conventional neutrino beam are. It's a high intensity proton beam from the main injector, 400 kilowatts to a megawatt, for the NUMMI beam, onto a target which then has a series of these focusing horns that Alan pointed out were invented now a long time ago. Then a long decay region for the pions and occasionally kaons to decay into our neutrinos. And then at the end, a number of shields and instrumentation that can help us pin down that neutrino beam. So the primary tool here that we use is pion decay to produce these neutrinos. And so there's a number of interesting aspects of it, and a lot of it has to do with the kinematics of it. And so the energy of the neutrino is some fraction of the pion energy that produces it, no more than 43%, and it drops off as we go off angle. And that's what's shown here, 43% of the pion energy over 1 plus gamma squared, that's the relativistic gamma of the pion, and theta squared is measured from the axis. And the muon then takes the balance of the energy. And so the energy drops as you go off axis. That leads to these off-axis neutrino beams. The flux also drops off relatively quickly, so it drops off. All two-body decays have this form, so the kaons decay for the most part this way as well. Of course, the three-body decays are a little more complicated. So this leads us to our other major tool that both T2K and NOVA use, but LBNF does not plan to use to any significant amount, and that's the off-axis mount. And so what's shown here is that if we can, if we look at the energy of the neutrino towards the beam and transverse to the beam here, that's what's plotted, and then plot on top of it these ovals here, which are related to different pion primary energies. You see that in the direction of the beam, so it's zero transverse energy, you get this direct correspondence of the neutrino energy to the pion energy. But if you go off angle, all of these start piling up on top of each other, and you can start to produce a more monoenergetic beam. And that's what T2K and now NOVA have done, taking this relatively broad medium energy beam, which you see on axis, and producing this much more peak beam off axis. And so now I'm going to go into some of the challenges that fit into this cartoon here. And one of them is hadron production. And so we have several tools for simulations that give us spectrums of neutrinos, but we have a constant question of what is the uncertainty of this. And this plays into all these long baseline beams. The hadron productions can constrain them. Presently, the most active one is this NA61 shine at CERN. Other possibilities, I guess, are John's experiment, and there have been other test beams as well. And the solution that Alan was referring to was a dedicated program of hadron production measurements that could really improve this. And I guess the spectrometer they're talking about is entirely reproducing a neutrino beam line, but without a neutrino detector, just a charged particle detector. And then on top of this, the modeling codes and the expertise that use all this do require maintenance and evolution. The codes like Jayant and Fluca and Mars, they actually don't have so much support in these areas. And this is a risk of ours going forward. Another challenge for us is the proton beam. And so what's often pointed out is that the SNS operates with a megawatt plus proton beam. But if I put the two of them to scale, here's the NUMMI beam corresponding to the much larger SNS beam. The SNS beam is scaled up to about 200 millimeters by 70 millimeters, where our beam is about 1.3 millimeters. What I don't also say is that our beam has about a megajoule of energy in it, whereas the SNS beam has about 20 kilojoules at different proton energies. But still, in some ways, our proton beam is much more challenging than what other megawatt facilities have to deal with. This is the greatest challenge for windows and targets, but it's also a significant challenge for peripheral devices. Targets, you hear about these a lot. There's a lot of challenges here. I'm not going to be able to go through them all, but optimizing the target is difficult because what you want from your optimal target is to be low Z but high density. That, of course, doesn't exist. And then it must also be able to survive for a long amount of time. And the issues there are radiation damage and thermomechanical shock of the material. So these have always been challenging devices for us. There are offsets in producing these in an efficient way, and what we learn will continue to be used going forward. A particular tool we have for that is the Radiate collaboration. This RADIATE stands for radiation damage and accelerator target environments. And here, this is us reaching out to other communities, accelerator communities like the spallation neutron community, but also the fission and fusion communities to try to share our knowledge of radiation damage. And so we have a broad collaboration now, which is moving forward and trying to address these challenges. The next challenge moving down the beam line in conventional beams is the horn focusing. So the horns act as lenses, and the NUMMI uses these parabolic horns, which act as somewhat linear lenses. LBNF uses somewhat more non-focusing optics, or non-imaging optics to produce the optimal neutrino beam. But regardless, there's a certain area of which you get the optimal production of the optimal focusing of particles. And so in NUMMI, it's about plus or 5 millimeters transversely and plus or 15 millimeters longitudinally, but the target's about a meter long. So the target already extends outside of our depth of focus. This isn't so bad actually, because the focal point depends on the energy of the pions. And so from the back part of the target, we can take the high energy pions, and from the front part, we can take the low energy pions. But still, we lose a little bit there. On the other hand, overall, the horn focusing is relatively efficient. I'll show a bit more on that later. But there's no factors of 100 or even a factor of 10 to be gained in improved horn focusing down the beam line. The big issue is building reliable devices like this. And an example of that, example of the complication there was the horn one failure we had back in 2016, I think it was. And this was our first 700 kilowatt horn. It had been in service, and it experienced this crack on a current feed. That's a big aluminum strip line there. It's about, I think, 8 inches across. So it's 20 centimeters, and a full centimeter thick, and it cracked through it. And it was due to fatigue enhanced by vibrations. This is a new problem that we now have to deal with all of our future horns. And then when this comes out, the device is, of course, quite radioactive. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done in terms of working around that and dealing with it. And that complicates every one of these devices. And then there's the long-term production of radiation, both prompt and residual. And then some of this radiation is also mobile. There can be airborne radiation, there can be waterborne isotopes, and keeping track of all these things is going to be a bigger and bigger problem as the facilities get larger and higher power. Another challenge is instrumentation. So we have instrumentation that we use to commission the beam line, to make measurements of the alignment of the components, alignment of the neutrino beam itself, make sure it's pointing in the right direction. Some of these have to sit in the beam, and so that leads us to a lot of challenges in terms of the survivability of these devices. And so we use those for alignment. And so an example that we use over and over is that when with the original NUMMI beam, we did a test. We scanned the proton beam across the target and measured the radiation, the beam that makes it down to different devices. Here it's the proton beam that makes it to our Hadron monitor. Here it's the muons that make it to the muon monitors. And what we found was that there's a small 1.2 millimeter offset of the target relative to the primary beam instrumentation. Now this offset would have been much too large for the systematic errors of the experiment. And so it was absolutely vital that we be able to find this. What it was found to be due to was a number of reasons, and we know that we have issues as the shielding is stacked, that the entire hull can just deform. That is, devices heat up, that their alignment changes, and we try to keep a really close eye on all these devices as we move forward. But every countermeasure that we put in place to reduce this type of variation is a complication that can potentially go wrong in terms of operation. All right, so now a little bit onto the experiments that are going on now and might be in the future. So Not so much was said about T2K here today, but we know it's operating and will be into the future. So I have a few slides here. So that they use this off-axis technique to super K, of course, and hopefully for them, hyper K in the future. They were the first application of this off-axis beam in production. And of course, they've made a lot of great discoveries there. They live on the J-Park facility that's relatively new in Japan. There they have a 400 MeV LINAC, two synchrotrons that produces a 30 GeV main ring, and then their neutrino beam sits underneath it. What you also see here is they also have a neutron source and what they call the Hadron Experimental Hall, where they do mostly KM physics, also other heavier hadrons, and eventually a mu to E type experiment. But they have this relatively new facility here, and they're gradually upgrading it. The neutrino facility sits actually underneath here. It was designed for a beam power of 750 kilowatts, which still hasn't actually met. They operate at about 470 kilowatts today. And their future upgrade is aiming now to 1.3 megawatts, although the facility was initially designed to be able to accommodate 4 megawatts. This is what their facility looks like, which isn't too different than what we have. So they have a target station, and they use three horns inside of their target station. The target actually sits within the first horn, and then they have a decay volume, and all of this is filled with helium. There's one large helium vessel that the beam goes through, and lots of water cooling around the outside, and you can see all this gray here. That's not dirt. That's concrete that was filled in. And so it's a very large, it was a very expensive facility. It's now been operating for quite a while. They're looking at a number of upgrade possibilities. The big upgrade that they want to do is the magnet power supply. They have a certain amount of budget available, and the first new power supply has been operational now. But unfortunately, they now think that this upgrade won't be complete until about 2021 or 2022. And that's shown here. This is kind of their upgraded projections for beam powers. This is today in Japan fiscal year. So actually right now is the beginning of Japan 18. They start on April 1st. And they plan to be operating around 500 kilowatts for the next several years. Then they'll do this magnet power supply upgrade, which will bring them to 700, 750 kilowatts in 2022. And then a gradual increase to 1.3 megawatts by the end of next decade. For us, we're operating NUMMI. I'm not going to say a lot about it, except that some interesting things about it is that it was designed for 400 kilowatts. It was upgraded to 700 kilowatts, and it's operating at that today. And we're upgrading it to be a megawatt capable by about 2021. So these facilities can be upgraded. And it's delivered about 35, 10 to the 20 protons to date.
Sorry, Bob, going back to the T2K. Yeah. So their proposal, I think timeline ends in 2026. Now you're showing them reaching, I mean, maybe 1 year of this is fiscal year definition, Japan versus the US. I don't know. It seems something slipped for them. They seem to be a year or two behind their proposal.
Yeah, so I mean, they're under very significant funding constraints, and so they were holding to a schedule that they weren't going to make. They were really holding on to it, and now they've reverted to kind of a realistic schedule. And so, between where they were saying 6 months ago and now, it looks like they've dropped 2 or 3 years. That's just because they were really holding on to an aggressive schedule. Maybe kind of like that LBNF shutdown in 2024.
What is percentage of operation?
I'm sorry.
What is percentage of operation?
Percentage of
neutrino.
Okay, so I didn't go through that. I didn't put that on here, but actually, one of the as a multi-purpose facility there at J Park, they don't have the capacity to serve that many users simultaneously. So the neutrino facility cannot be operated simultaneously with the Hadron facility. But it's even worse than that because they can't do beam studies while they're operating for users. So if they need 2 hours to do a beam study, they have to interrupt the beam for 2 full hours. And so what that means is that the uptime that they have for neutrino beams is relatively low. Probably about 25% of the year is for neutrino production at JPARC. And I really don't know if it's going to be improved very much in the future.
Their compensating advantage is that the tonnage of their detector is significantly bigger than...
Well, so there's advantages and disadvantages. It's bigger and closer. So they, you know, there. So we do have a short baseline neutrino beam here. I threw it in just because we do have an upgrade possibility for it, which is on the books, but we're not pursuing it presently. So it's been operating now for about 15 years, has itself also a significant number of protons delivered. And it's required work over time. We've replaced two horns and we're on the third one now. And so a number of people did do some significant amount of work showing how we could put a larger, more efficient horn into the booster neutrino beam. And this one actually did have a significant increase in neutrino flux. Depending on where you looked, it was between 50% and 150% increase. But it's not being pursued because funding's part of it, timing's part of it, and just the difficulty of doing this. Okay, so LBNF is where we think we'll be getting in a decade or so. So it'll be designed for 1.2 megawatts, upgradable to something beyond 2 megawatts, and its parameters are not so different than NUMMI. Its beam size might be a little bit larger. It might use 60 GeV photons instead. Its decay pipe is shorter. Of course, the angle's larger to go to the longer baseline. Its target pile starts to maybe look a little bit more like T2K now. There are three horns with the target within the horn. In this case, the target is very long, perhaps twice as long as the neutrino, the NUMMI target. And then this all sits inside of here, actually, a nitrogen volume and a helium decay pipe. So a lot of work's gone on this. And part of it recently done was to improve the optimization of the beam for the physics, and so you know it depends on where you look, but it improves the effectiveness of the beam somewhere 50% to 100%, and what's shown here is just to what significance the 50% of the CP range is covered as a function of exposure for an optimized design and what was called the reference design, the previous design. And so what you're supposed to look at is the gap between these red and blue black curves horizontally and say the red can get there much faster. And it can do that for CP sensitivity and the matter hierarchy sensitivity. And so this is the kind of improvements that can be done with fine-tuning the focusing. This was a significant improvement. And there's really, on a conventional neutrino beam, there's really not that much further you can go. So on the other side of improvements that we're going to have, it's going to be just photon power improvement. That's the most straightforward improvement we can do. So the first that'll be done about a decade or so from now is the Proton Improvement Plan 2, PIP2. That should give us this 1.2 megawatt power. The intention is that this gets built concurrently with LBNF and that it provides 1.2 megawatts at day zero of the beam. In terms of technology, it's relatively well understood. It's just expensive. So it's a matter of finding space for it. Beyond that, we have PIP3, and there's no PIP3 project. There's no really conceptual design. Right now, it's a set of different concepts of how we can get to something in the 2 to 5 megawatt range for future experiments, which could include LBNF. And there's three general options: extend this LINAC to 8 GeV and inject directly to the main injector or recycler. Extend the LINAC to 2 GeV or some number like that and inject into a new RCS or booster, or develop new technologies that allow us to build some kind of new rapid cycling synchrotron that gets us up to very high power. And so there's R&D going on now that do go into this decision. There's efforts to reduce the cost of superconducting RF and also what we call the FAST IOTA program, which is exploring new ways to to focus beam in a synchrotron that might make it more efficient. Okay, so when we go forward, we have to, with conventional beam lines, there's a limited number of options and also a certain number of limits, and we have to balance them against each other. And so some of the limits that go on top of these are things like the pion decay angle. And so there's nothing we can really do about that as long as we're sticking with pions to produce the neutrinos. There's always going to be an intrinsic angle on it, and so the beam will always spread out, and we'll always lose neutrino flux that way. Hadron production is a limit in terms of precision, but also in terms of the angle from the production. These pions come off at a rather large angle from the target, and that's a somewhat irreducible angular spread as well, without going to something like a neutrino factory, or where there's some kind of cooling. On the option side, the obvious thing to go to is higher beam power. So that's kind of the most straightforward thing. We talked about focusing a little bit. You can look at perfect focusing and see how much better it does. Generally, the gains are not very large. There's some talk about tailoring the focusing. It's kind of a combination with an off-axis beam so that you get really the pions that you want. We know that there's the off-axis beam. It's presently not what LBNF wants for the Dune experiment, but the beam will exist, and so there can be an off-axis detector. There's other narrowband options, such as adding dipoles or quadrupoles to try to narrow up the beam line. If there's an entirely different beam line, you could imagine a longer baseline. Again, the physics would have to run you in that direction. Longer baseline will always produce these lower event rates. So there's a major trade-off there. We can think about flavor enhancing the beams. So you can try to suppress muon decays to suppress electron neutrinos in the beam. LBNF actually does that by having a shorter decay pipe. That's the strategy there. But there are other strategies to try to deflect or absorb muons to avoid this effect. Another problem that we know about is tertiary interactions, and here I just don't mean in the target, but in the material around the target. So the Minos experiment discovered that a large number of the Rongstein neutrinos actually came from particle production in things like the decay pipe itself, where unused pions would interact and would produce different pions, which then produced antineutrinos. Or if they were trying to produce an antineutrino beam, it would produce neutrinos. And so there's different strategies you could do there to try to reduce those. We talk a little bit about tau neutrinos. Either you have to go to higher energy than 120 JeV to really get up into that charm area, or actually now you get to moderately higher energies, and you depend on oscillations to actually give you a lot of tau neutrinos from the muon neutrinos. So you depend on knowing your oscillation parameters well enough that you know how many tau neutrinos are there. And so all of these have to be put against each other. The bottom line is that conventional beams are probably approaching their limits, barring whether there's really any new measurement need or application that we don't know about yet. And so that's really what has to come over the next 10 years, is if there's some, what these various experiments discover and what they ask for. The obvious improvements for conventional neutrino beams are higher beam power, and there the improvement, it's going to be less than a factor of 10. I don't think we're ever going to go above, tens of megawatts, just from a practicality point of view. And then focusing, where there is some scope for improvement, but unfortunately it's probably not more than a factor of 2. The other side of it is customizing the beam line. That's things like the baseline, the flavor composition, and the energy spectrum. And then at the end, there's just numerous challenges in doing all of these things, especially as you combine them together. And that's it for me.
Simple question. What is hydro production? Is it water as a target or?
Hadron production?
Yeah.
Okay. So sorry for not getting into too much detail. So hadron production means the production of hadrons. So from the target. So as the proton comes through and interacts with the nuclei, through you produce these many pions, kaons, you know, protons, neutrons, antiprotons, all anything that's a hadron from the target, and it's not. I mean, it's not a well-known topic. I mean, well, in principle,
they are always present there in many systems.
Well, but it's how we make the neutrino beam. So it's a question of how many pions come out at which angle and with what energy. So and there's a lot of uncertainty there about the nuclear interactions that go on. And so there's a lot of effort that has to be done to understand those. It's been a recurring problem. In principle, it's all determined by QCD and it's all known exactly. But you can't calculate it from first principles. So it all has to be derived from data.
So another question. So what's the capacity of the envisioned accelerator complex to support a low-energy neutrino beam in the Dune era? Let's say either EV-scale stereo neutrinos are found, or I come up with some other exciting program that I can do with a, I guess I shouldn't say necessarily neutrino beam, the low energy, the BNB or BNB. Something or something similar coming from whatever's injecting into.
So again, it really depends on what's found there. But I don't believe our plans are now to disable the booster neutrino beam. We have kind of a horizon, which is roughly the long shutdown in the middle of the next decade. And we're prepared to operate the BNB that long. Beyond that point, we don't presently have any kind of plan. On the other hand, we're not presently planning to disable it either.
Yeah, so that's my question. Since this is post 2026, so assuming after the long shutdown when we have the upgrades, the booster's still there. It's still able to feed a booster neutrino beam line, and I'm also curious about, you know, how many protons you can send down that beam line without affecting the Dune program, that sort of thing. What's its capacity to be operated simultaneously?
It wouldn't be so different than today, because the BNB would operate very similar. I mean, the LBNF would operate very similarly to NUMMI, and without any upgrade, BNB can't take much more. So it would depend also then on whether you did an upgrade program for the BNB. But I would think something similar to what's available today would be available for the BNB. But this is an important question, because probably it would be easier for LBNF to build their beam line in such a way that did disable the BNB, because they actually intersect the main injector at the same part. So it could actually, you know, save LBNF some certain amount of money and time to not have to worry about the BNB. So going forward, if maintaining that capability is important, it's good that we keep that in mind, because otherwise somebody might just fill it with dirt. And
we can let other people measure stereo neutrinos when they're found.
Again, it depends on what we find, and we got to make the argument. But right now, you know, we've got a program, and we'll see what it says several years from now.
If there isn't any other questions, we've been here quite a long time, so we're not going to have discussion time now. The kind of point of this first session was to kind of generally set the scene and then come back and discuss in more detail, you know, what we think are the most important measurements, and with what we learn are the facilities which we think we can build on this kind of time scale. So let's thank all our speakers, especially Peter, because we didn't clap. We haven't set the date, depending on, we were going to invite some speakers, so we hadn't actually confirmed the date. It'll probably be probably be the end of next week or the beginning of the week after.
Well, we have two more after this before the 26th?
Yeah, so there's going to be like one a week. Yeah. Shorter, probably. Okay, let's thank our speakers again. Thank Peter from coming out and sitting for all of this. We will send around some notes, and we also recorded this, so if I don't mind, we'll
send it to my lawyer before you.
I'll do. I get one of those sign-off sheets from Visual Media Studio.
Yeah. I'm sure I gravely insulted some double beta decay.
Who's somebody left a wallet or something here? Or a case? This belong to anybody?
Glasses.
Also want to push, I can do the analysis down to 30 dB or lower.